The president's travel ban gets challenged in the Supreme Court.
The idea that the president believes, and that was his intent when he signed these orders, was to keep people of a particular religion out of the country is highly significant.
President Trump's own words are key as justices decide if the travel ban is constitutional. Also, an investigation reveals a pattern of sexual abuse in immigration detention.
59% of the allegations identify an officer, so that's an ICE staffer or a contractor, as the alleged perpetrator.
And a look at the underground ballroom scene in New York City and the home it provides young queer people of color.
It's like going to the Oscars. I felt like I had gotten a ticket to the Oscars and everybody was black and gay.
This is the Takeaway Podcast for Wednesday, April 25th, 2018.
We're going to take our case as far as it needs to go, including all the way up to the Supreme Court. And let me tell you something. I think we ought to go back to the first one and go all the way, which is what I wanted to do in the first place.
President Trump reacts to the courts blocking his travel ban on Muslim-majority countries back in March 2017. Well, the president gets his wish. Today, the Supreme Court hears oral arguments on his travel ban. The ban is now in its third version as the administration has worked to get around various legal challenges. In its current form, the travel ban bars most people from five predominantly Muslim countries: Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. It also includes North Korea and some government officials from Venezuela. But to understand the travel ban, you have to go back to late 2015. Here was candidate Donald Trump campaigning in December of that year.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Trump v. Hawaii is before the justices today. Faiza Patel is co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program, which filed an amicus brief against the ban. Faiza, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, Faiza, that statement from Donald Trump when he was a candidate, December 2015, it gets played all the time. How important is that statement to the case today and the president's intent when he signed the executive order instituting the travel ban?
It's actually critical to the case. The case argues that the point of the ban was to ban Muslims from coming into the United States. And the government has argued, no, that's not the point. The point was a national security purpose. And it goes to showing the intent behind the ban. So it's that first statement that you just played back from December 2015, but then ongoing statements that Trump has made while he was a candidate and then continuing to make during the time that he's been president as well.
Now, what does the government say to this claim? I mean, the statements are clear. They are what they are. But does the government say that despite the statements of candidate Trump, many Muslim countries aren't under the travel ban? So how could this be a religious ban?
Yeah, I mean, the government argues many things. Its primary argument is that this is an exercise of the president's national security and foreign relations discretion, and so the courts really just shouldn't be going behind what's written in the executive order. They also point out that obviously not all Muslims are covered by this ban. Nonetheless, the fact that the ban was premised on the idea that Muslims should be kept out of the country, I don't think really takes away from its discriminatory intent and impact.
So, Faiza, the ban has changed. It's been through several iterations since the first one, January 27th of 2017, at the beginning of the Trump presidency. Can you describe how it's changed, how it's narrowed to get to the point today so that the ban that's in front of the court is the one that justices are dealing with?
Sure. The very first ban was very expansive, and it applied not just to people traveling to the United States from other countries, but also to permanent residents of the United States. It also included language which made it clear that it didn't include Christians from these countries under the ban. The second iteration of the ban was a little narrower in that it took away this preference for Christians from the countries named in the ban, and also exempted green card holders from the ban. Nonetheless, it also focused on Muslim countries. The third iteration, which came out in the fall of last year, took a slightly different tack in that it justified the ban on the grounds that we simply didn't have enough cooperation and information from the countries named in the ban to allow citizens from there to come into the United States.
Now, Justice Neil Gorsuch is relatively new on the court, Faisa, but do you see anything in the historical opinions, the voting patterns, or the decisions of the liberals and the conservatives on the court that point you to how justices may rule here?
Well, you know, traditionally, when cases go to the Supreme Court, everybody watches what Justice Kennedy is going to do. And I think that that's, again, going to be very critical over here, how he views the ban. I also think that, you know, if the justices are prepared to look with any degree of care at this ban, that they're going to find it unconstitutional or illegal under the Immigration and Nationality Act. The question really is, how closely are the justices going to look, or are they going to buy the government's argument that, you know, this is a national security matter and you just really shouldn't be interfering?
Realistically, what are you looking for from the court here? A complete strike down, or more realistically, some sort of slapback, some sort of limitation on the Trump administration's ability to enact this ban here?
So I think it's important to remember that the procedural posture of this case, so the ban hasn't actually been litigated on the merits ever. The courts have issued what's called a preliminary injunction stopping the ban from going into effect. But the Supreme Court has allowed the ban to go forward while it considers this case. So the ban is currently in effect. Now, the court is going to be ruling on whether or not to uphold the preliminary injunction. I think what people challenging the ban, like myself, hope for is the court will say, yes, this preliminary injunction should be upheld because the plaintiffs have demonstrated that they're likely to succeed on the merits of the claim. At that point, I think it's very difficult for the government to go back and recraft the ban because they will have lost over three iterations of the ban. I mean, you know, so I think that's a very good outcome for people. Alternatively, the court can decide, well, no, this preliminary injunction wasn't justified, either because they find that there's no likelihood of success on the merits, or because they find some other equitable reason for allowing this to go forward. So in that case, the case would technically go back down to the lower courts, although I think it becomes very challenging for those of us who oppose the ban at that point. A third possibility, which I think is unlikely but could happen, is that if the court has a difficult time coming to agreement on this, then they could sort of find a way to split the baby, if you will, and potentially send this case back down to the lower courts for them to develop a more extensive factual record, for example. So there are three possibilities on the table. I think the third one's, as a practical matter, probably pretty unlikely. So I think we're looking probably at one of the first two.
Faisa Patel, co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, since last January, the various versions of the travel ban have changed how millions of people come and go from the United States. Like Tara Separi-Farr, she came to the U.S. as a student from Iran in 2010. She's now a researcher at Human Rights Watch, but at the time of the first travel ban, she was a green card holder.
We were expecting some version of the travel ban, but the version that was first communicated was extremely broad and brief, in a sense that there was no clarity in what exactly it excludes and what doesn't. And for me, I was in the middle of planning another trip to the UK to participate in a conference, and all of a sudden started hearing from the news that I might not be able to come back to the country where I now call home if I leave the country for my work trip. And that started to hurt because I came here now some 8 years ago. And because of the kind of work I do and my background of activism, I don't go back to my home country. I can't. It's actually risky for me to go back, and I will be subjected to harassment. And so I have nowhere else to go. It was later clarified that green card holders were not subjected to the law. So ultimately, I could travel, but for a short period, we actually were instructed by our organization just not to travel because it was too risky and no one wanted to figure out how to get us out of airport detention centers or anything like that.
Now, the travel ban, of course, has been winding its way through the courts ever since. Lots of challenges. Tara, what about your family? You have family in Iran who I guess you haven't seen in quite a while. Are they able to travel to the U.S.? Have they tried?
As I mentioned, because I don't travel to Iran at the moment, I have to see my family somewhere else. And the ideal would be for them to come here so I can host them. And my parents applied for a tourist visa in March 2017 because my partner and I were planning to get married here in the United States. But my parents were still refused the visa, which actually made us change our plans. And to this day, they have not reapplied, because even if they apply under the newest version of the travel ban, the standard is very high, and you basically have to provide documentation why they should be exempted from this blanket ban that is still in place for many nationalities.
So Tara, what are you looking for from the Supreme Court today and in the coming months as they deliberate? Are you looking for the court to do away with the travel ban entirely, or do you think it's appropriate to have some level of increased security from some countries, but that it needs to be fair?
I totally understand the broad power the president has in terms of setting regulation in matters related to immigration policy. And I also totally understand that there are legitimate risks that any country should take into account when they're trying to secure their borders. But I think the problem with the travel ban, and I think the implementation of different phases of travel ban speaks for itself, is the discriminatory intent and the lack of clear objectives in what exactly they are trying to prevent, other than broadly labeling people based on their national origin as threat to national security. I don't think it does any good, or it doesn't send any positive message to people inside Iran that I know the U.S. administration has been talking about caring about them. I don't think that's the kind of message that would be well received at home either.
Tara Separi-Farr, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tara Separi-Farr is an Iranian-American, a researcher at Human Rights Watch.
This is Mehdi from Kirkland, Washington. My wife is 7 months pregnant with my second son. And since all our family are from Iran, we really don't have any help at this moment. And she will be completely alone. No family, no relatives could come and help us because of the travel ban. I hope that things will change for good.
Your voice at 8778-MY-TAKE. Two years ago, reporter Alicia Sperry began investigating reports of physical and sexual abuse in U.S. immigration detention facilities across the country. A grim pattern emerged from more than 1,200 complaints and hundreds of Freedom of Information Act requests. A majority of the alleged perpetrators were actually staff or contractors of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. In many other cases, officers witnessed the abuse and did nothing to stop it. Alicia Sperry is with The Intercept, and she shares her findings.
The reports are a little bit all over the place. I think an important part of the story is just how poor the record keeping is and how inconsistently these allegations are recorded. But one picture that does emerge, even though the data itself is fairly limited, is just how massive and systemic this abuse is. And we ran our own analysis of these complaints, and we actually found some really troubling conclusions. One of them is that 59% of the allegations identify an officer, so that's an ICE staffer or a contractor, as the alleged perpetrator. Another 34% identify an officer as a witness, so we had an officer that either witnessed directly or was told about the abuse. And then in another 22% of cases, we have both an officer as the alleged perpetrator and an officer as a witness, which really tells you, you know, not just how incompetent and how poorly ICE and immigration detention centers protect the people they're tasked with detaining and protecting, but also how complicit they are in that abuse.
Now, 1,200 cases, more than 1,200 cases, is a big number, but give a size of the universe here. Does that suggest that this type of sexual abuse is rampant, happening every day of the week? What's the denominator here?
So first of all, the numbers we have come from the Office of Inspector General, which is an independent office within DHS that is tasked with monitoring different agencies, including ICE. I actually filed a FOIA request with ICE itself 2 years ago, and ICE never complied with it. So we don't have the full picture that ICE has. The OIG's numbers are partial in a sense. ICE did respond to my request for comments just a few hours before publication, and they gave me their numbers. And basically they said, you know, we have less than 300 reports of sexual assault and abuse every year. the detainee population is about 40,000 men, women, and children on any given day. But those are still pretty staggering numbers. And we also know there are a number of reports that never actually get written down, and there is no record and documentation for them. The other important thing in reference to the 1,200 complaints we got is that through the FOIA request we filed with the OIG, we were initially told that the OIG received 33,000 complaints of various types of abuses happening in detention. And for reasons that remain a mystery to us, the OIG actually responded to my record request twice. The first time sending aggregate data that pointed to these 33,000 complaints, and the second time giving us actually narratives for these 1,200 complaints. So I think it's important to read these numbers with the understanding that they're by no means comprehensive, and we can't even tell exactly what percentage of the full picture they portray, because we just don't have the full numbers. And I think another really important point here is that ICE is actually required to publish all numbers related to sexual assault that happens in detention every year. Still, they have never actually done it.
What types of abuse are we talking about across these 1,200 cases or more?
So we asked for all data relating to sexual harassment and assault and physical abuse in immigration detention. The data we were given by the OIG is really all over the place in the amount of detail they provide. So we have a number of complaints that only say, you know, assault or sexual assault or rape without further description or sort of without further details about the incident. And then we have these excruciatingly graphic and really detailed allegations of rape that happen. We also have a number of reports of verbal abuse, of physical abuse that's non-sexual in nature. And we have a significant number of allegations that concern minors.
Now, you traveled to an ICE detention facility in California to report part of this story. What did you find?
Yes, I traveled to the Adelanto ICE Processing Center in Adelanto, California, just 2 years ago, around the time that I filed this FOIA request. And I was really interested in seeing what is the process for detainees that want to report abuse. And the system is actually there. ICE has some pretty solid policies in place. So detainees that are taken into detention, they're given an orientation in which they're told what their rights are. They're given a manual that details how they can report abuse. There are mailboxes that are locked all around the detention facility, and detainees can use those to file complaints anonymously. And then there are numbers that are posted on flyers all around the facility that detainees are invited to call. So, like, the system is there. The problem is the implementation of these policies and sort of the system of checks and balances on each facility to make sure that the guards that are working are not actually pressuring detainees not to file a complaint.
What you're saying suggests that there is a broad policy from the very top that would demand accountability for sexual assault in ICE facilities, but that the rank and file, the people actually policing or guarding these facilities, don't take it very seriously.
Yes, but the leadership is ultimately responsible to everything that happens in its centers. And, you know, ICE maintains that it has a zero tolerance policy for all forms of abuse in detention. They do have this sets of policies in place that require all facilities to have prevention and intervention programs in place. And they actually audit these facilities for compliance with PREA standards. And I think that's interesting, because that does show some of the failures on part of the ICE leadership as well. So, for instance, they didn't actually start auditing facilities until last year. So far, they've only audited about 77% of them, and they've actually found them all in compliance with standards, even though we know from advocates and detainees and attorneys that there is rampant abuse in some of these detention centers.
Right. So where does this go, Alicia? If your reporting and the documents that you got from your FOIA request and the statements of detainees themselves and advocates say that this type of abuse is rampant in ICE detention centers, but 77% of facilities have been audited and the agency says things are peachy, where does this go?
You know, advocates have been warning about this for years, and there just hasn't been a really solid response. I think one of the problems is that ICE detains just so many people, and just the sheer number of individuals in its custody make it so much more difficult to implement even good policies that may be in place. And I think one of the things that advocates will say is that there just doesn't need to be that much detention. If ICE cut its population in half or more than that, then it would be a lot easier to really put in place some serious oversight.
Alicia Sperry, reporter with The Intercept, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I take a backseat to no one with my views of the threat that is presented to America from Russia. And if I am confirmed as the Secretary of State, I can assure you this administration will continue, as it has for the past 15 months, to take real actions to push back, to reset the deterrence relationship with respect to Russia.
That is CIA Director and Secretary of State nominee Mike Pompeo telling senators at his confirmation hearing he's no pushover when it comes to Russia. Pompeo's expected to get confirmed by the Senate by the end of this week. Now, the nomination comes as the United States sits on the cusp of monumental foreign initiatives with Russia, North Korea, Syria, Iran, and other countries as well. Ori Friedman is a reporter with The Atlantic. He's here. Ori, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Todd. Good to be with you.
Ori, up until Monday, it looked like Mike Pompeo would not get a majority of votes out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee before heading to the Senate floor. What changed that?
Two things, I think. One, it became clear that moderate Democrats in the Senate, when the vote went to a full Senate vote as opposed to committee, that they were going to vote for Mike Pompeo. And so he was going to get confirmed one way or the other. And so I think it became clear the Senate Foreign Relations Committee vote was more symbolic. Secondly, Rand Paul, the Republican from Kentucky, who has more libertarian views on foreign policy, had initially said he was going to vote against Mike Pompeo. Mike Pompeo and Donald Trump both called Rand Paul and gave him a variety of assurances. For example, that Mike Pompeo thought the Iraq war was a mistake, that the U.S. would get out of Afghanistan soon, and that regime change had destabilized the Middle East. This is all according to Rand Paul. And when he got those assurances, he decided to change his vote because he felt convinced enough that Mike Pompeo wasn't kind of the neoconservative hawk that he had accused him of being during the Senate confirmation process. So those are the two big differences.
So some moderate Democrats are on board. Rand Paul is on board. Mike Pompeo looks to be headed toward confirmation. Now, he doesn't have a lot of diplomatic experience, Ori. And this is at a time when the U.S. is headed into difficult decisions, possible negotiations over the Iran nuclear deal, high-stake talks, of course, with North Korea, wars in the Middle East, Syria, and Yemen. What's he bringing to the job here?
The biggest thing, I think, is a close relationship with the president. And that matters in foreign policy. Rex Tillerson, almost from the get-go, felt very marginalized and at odds with the president on many key issues. Mike Pompeo, during as CIA director, has personally briefed the president. He's established a very good rapport with the president, and that matters for two reasons. One, for the State Department, they will feel that their leader has the president's ear. And then secondly, when you're a State Department top diplomat going out in the world, you want foreign officials to think you speak for the president. I don't think a lot of foreign officials thought Rex Tillerson did. I think they will think Mike Pompeo does.
Now, on the other hand, the Secretary of State job is one of the traditional cabinet seats where the secretary is expected to speak truth to power to the president, to often tell the president things that he doesn't want to hear. And a lot of observers point out that that did not work out for Rex Tillerson, as you mentioned. But what about Mike Pompeo? He gets along with the president. Can he tell the president things that he doesn't like?
One of the most striking things in the confirmation process for Mike Pompeo was that the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a Republican, Bob Corker, started off the confirmation hearing by saying, "I'm concerned you're going to be a yes man, that you're not going to be a check on the president." Now, that's remarkable for the president, someone of the own party of the president to be concerned that the person they're nominating won't be a check on the president's impulses. But that really is a concern. I think Mike Pompeo may not stand up, will stand up in private to the president. The question is whether he will stand up in public once a decision is made. He seems to be more of an enthusiastic defender of the president than one who is afterwards going to question the president's decisions.
Ori Friedman, reporter with The Atlantic, reporting on Mike Pompeo's foreign policy stances and his relationship with his boss, President Donald Trump, as he likely enters the job of Secretary of State. Ori Friedman, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. It helps us in ways you can't imagine. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter. They'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. All right, now back to the show.
Violent protests broke out in Nicaragua last week in response to the government's plans to overhaul the nation's social security system. Police controlled by President Daniel Ortega brutally cracked down on protesters, leaving upwards of two dozen people dead, including a journalist who's reporting via Facebook when he was shot and killed. President Ortega walked back his reforms on Sunday, but the unrest has continued and protesters are now calling for him to step down. Joining us from Managua is Francis Robles with the New York Times. Francis, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Francis, these protests started out over proposed changes to the Social Security system, as I said. What are those changes? What brought people into the streets, and why did they cause such an immediate backlash?
The proposal would have had workers paying more towards their Social Security, and it would have had retirees receiving less. So people were really, really upset. People from all sectors, poor people, working people, retired people. And so when the students went out to protest this, there was quite a strong response from the government. And so then the whole thing just exploded, so that now really the Social Security issue almost has nothing to do with it.
So the protests started with students, as you mentioned, and then they spread. How did they evolve?
What happened was that when the police attacked the students, and also the government has these kind of young paramilitary type forces that come in and in support of the government, throwing rocks and attacking the students, the backlash against that violence, against those deaths, was so strong that then you started seeing people in the community pouring out. You started seeing people from the government's own Sandinista party coming out and joining protests. The line really clearly had been crossed. The Nicaraguan people were just not going to tolerate the deaths of college students.
30 people died. The response from police, was this ordered from the top?
Well, that's clearly the sense from the protesters. People don't think that the police would have taken it upon themselves to show such violence against innocent protesters. And so the issues, it's that, it's freedom of the press, it's the Supreme Court, it's re-election, it's term limits, you know, so that now the issues are so vast that they really strike to a bigger issue, which is the rule of law in Nicaragua.
Because on Sunday, Daniel Ortega backed down, announced he was scrapping those Social Security plans that we started with. But you're saying, Francis Robles, this, it's gone well beyond that now. That's not going to satisfy protesters.
It was a very days-old response. It's almost like he came out on Sunday to say something that would have satisfied the public on Wednesday, and not really having a sense of the pulse of the people, of the streets that he has lost, clearly. Now, even he has actually ceded on several important points. A television station that had been taken off the air was put back on yesterday. I don't know about all of them, but a lot of the students that had been arrested during the protests were released. And so I think from his perspective, hey, look, I'm meeting all your demands. You know, the Social Security was reformed, the kids were released, the TV's back on the air. And now I went last night to this one campus that the students have taken over now for a week. And they said, we're not leaving here until he resigns.
So stepping back from the immediate issues, the Social Security issue, and of course, the violent response to these protests and the 30 people who died, is there a broader anti-Ortega movement developing here? Do people have grievances that extend well beyond any of these issues or the rule of law and the protests themselves?
Oh, sure. I mean, the rule of law, it all goes down to the rule of law. I mean, it goes down to the way that he governs. He's made a lot of changes, institutional changes to, let's say, the framework of the Supreme Court, to messing around with the National Assembly, changing the Constitution to eliminate term limits. I mean, that was a big one. And the Electoral Council is also another big one. So that people feel that there's no chance here to have a fair, like you could say, oh, well, just take this up at the next election. People don't trust the elections because they don't trust the Electoral Council. They don't trust the counting of the votes. So that there is a very vast institutional problem in Nicaragua that all boils down to Daniel Ortega and his wife, Rosario Murillo, who is the vice president. And I don't, you know, it's funny. I've asked people yesterday several times, you know, can you dialogue? You know, they want to dialogue. Okay, can you dialogue democracy? You know, I don't know how that works, to be honest, because that's really what it's about.
What's been the American response here, Francis? There was a time when the United States took a very deep, intimate interest in the affairs of Nicaraguans, and I'm putting it mildly. The U.S. support for the Contras and the Nicaraguan Civil War in 1980 is part of Daniel Ortega's history going back in Nicaragua. But what's the Americans' posture now?
Well, the State Department and the White House have condemned the violence here, and they also took the step of asking the ordering home the relatives of the people at the U.S. Embassy. So there's definitely a sense that that it's dangerous here, that they don't know what's going to happen from one day to the next.
Is there an endpoint to what you're seeing in the streets as you talk to student protesters, others who've poured into the streets? Of course, they say they want Daniel Ortega to go. I don't expect that you have a sense he's going, at least not willingly, anytime soon. So what's the endpoint of this clash?
That's a really big question. What the older people don't want is for the endpoint to be another civil war that destroys this country for years and years. I don't know. I don't know what the students will accept, because it's on them.
Are there any viable alternatives to Daniel Ortega who could take power or at least be a champion of the protest? Has anyone emerged who could take this movement forward?
This is a leaderless opposition, which makes it so fascinating. It makes it really hard for Daniel Ortega to quash it, because there isn't one person to blame.
And maybe not one person to take up a mantle if they want Daniel Ortega to go. The question is, who's next and who might be better in Nicaragua? Francis Robles with the New York Times from Managua. Francis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's rewind for a minute to right about this time back in 1990. Here's the song that was number one on Billboard's Hot 100. Madonna sent Vogue all the way to the top of the charts, but the dancing on display in that famous video didn't start with her. Voguing with its hand movements and strutting and flash came out of New York City's underground ballroom scene created by queer people of color back in the 1960s. Since its very start, ballroom culture has been a safe haven for Black and Latinx LGBT people, a place where they could go to fully express themselves.
It's like going to the Oscars. I felt like I had gotten a ticket to the Oscars and everybody was Black and gay.
That's Elegance Bratton talking about his very first ball. Elegance was 16 when his mother kicked him out of the house for being gay. He took a train from New Jersey into New York City, and he found himself in the middle of a scene that he only knew from the movies. It looked a lot like the 1990 documentary Paris is Burning.
And I'd seen Paris is Burning as a kid. That's another thing. When I was in my mother's house, I'd watched Jenny Livingston's film so much. I used to like have conversations with those characters on screen. And so when I got to the pier, I had already kind of understood what it was. So when that happened to me, I was like, oh my God, this is great. I finally have family, so to speak.
The ballroom scene started in New York City, but today it's worldwide. And Elegance Bratton has made his own documentary about the New York scene. It's called My House, and it's now a 10-episode series premiering tonight on Viceland. I sat down with Elegance to talk about his series and to learn more about ballroom culture.
The way I describe the ballroom scene, it's a gender competitive circuit made up of predominantly Black and Latino folks who've lost connections to their families as a result of their sexuality or gender expression, and create new families called houses in the ballroom scene. And these families, like families all over America, use their culture as a way to compete with one another to see which family is like the best family. So for instance, you have the House of LaBeija, the House of Ebony, the House of Mizrahi, the House of Khan. All of these houses in some way, shape, or form are represented on our show.
Well, that's fascinating, because I just want to make it clear for people, you know, the families provide support for all of their members,
yes,
as you mentioned, and people represent their families when they go to these balls. But the balls themselves, I mean, really, it's about dance, right? When you're representing, it's to the music. And voguing, it's really about the moves.
I'd say voguing is the culmination of all of the categories. There's like hundreds of categories that have existed in ballroom. There's categories like labels, where you show up in your highest fashion label brand. You have runway, where it's you're trying to be a fashion model. There's European runway, there's American runway, there's all of that. So that voguing is the culmination of all the categories. It's all of the realnesses, to me anyway, in one category. Your femininity is judged, your presentation is judged, your catwalk is judged, your hand performance is judged, your ability to tell the story with the movements is judged. So that voguing is very often the most popular category at any ball, right? The butch queen Vogue Femme, or Femme Queen performance, or overall performance. There's so many derivations. There's dramatics. There's so many different derivations of Vogue. But at the end of the day, the dance form itself is the full representation of the panoply of gender representations that ballroom is meant to raise up and to, on some level, there's a pedagogy to this too. Like, these are young people. You come into the scene, you know, 17, 18 years old, right? And you might be coming from a family that's like transphobic or homophobic, so you don't really get the chance to learn how to be the best version of the self that you want to be. Very often you've been pressured to be something that you're not, right? So that when you go to a ball and you walk these categories, you are literally coming of age and learning how to walk like a woman, talk like a woman, gesture like a woman, you know, be a real man, seem threatening like a real man, you know, things that you may not be able to get in your family home because people are uncomfortable with who you are innately. You're able to get in the ballroom and you win a trophy and some cash.
You know, another thing struck me, and you brought it up, all the outfits, the underwear, the gear, the clothes, the labels. There's a lot going on here with expression and belonging and finding your own identity, but elegance, it's got to be expensive. I hope you got to have a day job to be big on this scene, don't you?
Well, you know, class is definitely one of the things that the show attempts to deal with, right? When I think of what Vogue dancing is, I look at it as a representation of, like, the long and short of it, these kids throw themselves up in the air, fall down onto the ground and appear to be dead, and then get right back up again and keep doing it over and over and over again, right? And I think that aspect of the dance form speaks to their class experience in contemporary, you know, gentrifying New York City. And when we talk about, you know, the need for a day job, a huge part of the ballroom scene is to, at least from my perception of the ballroom scene, is to legitimize identity through rewarding it. And the need for that reward is often because of a genuine lack of access to suitable employment, to real economic opportunities, so that these kids can take, it's like that RuPaul's Drag Race challenge. You know, you go to the dollar store and come out and look like $1 million, you know, like, I'm not going to characterize everyone like that. Many people are buying designer clothes. Many people are really pulling out all the stops. But what I love about the ballroom scene, what I love about the culture, is that people are like, this is homegrown. You know, these are folks who have got a sewing machine and they go to the fabric store and they will put a look together. They will find something that you would never think could be even an outfit and put it on their hips, and all of a sudden you'll see something that looks similar walking down the runways of Paris, you know? So as expensive as it is, it really looks more expensive than it is sometimes. And a reason why that happens is because of just the stuff that we all know. You know, there's a lot of barriers for people of color, especially queer people of color, to have that type of employment that you speak of. So they have to find other solutions to make sure that they look at that their outside expresses the value that they seek to have inside.
And then within that elegance in your show, you know, you portray this world at the balls of confidence and art and dance and representation.
What I tell people about this show, my goal and intention with this show, was to show America the best Voguers in the world, the best of the best of what this culture has to offer. And in so doing, following them as they prepare for battle, we get to learn about what it's like to be in these gay families. What I want people to do is to be able to watch this show, attach themselves to the humanity, the incredible dignity and humanity and brilliance of this cast. And then when they leave watching this show, to go out in the world and make it better for someone who looks like someone in this cast, or make it better for someone who lives like someone in this cast, or at the very least, you know, recognize that person's humanity.
The show is My House on Viceland. Elegance Bratton is the creator and co-executive producer. Elegance, what a pleasure. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. It was really, really great.
And we end our show with this note from history. Today marks the 25th anniversary of the 1993 March on Washington for lesbian, gay, and bi equal rights and liberation. At a time when the country was in the midst of the AIDS crisis and same-sex marriage wasn't even discussed in national politics, activist Irva Shivad addressed the crowd on the National Mall.
I am proud to stand before you as a lesbian. We have come in peace and with courage to say, America, this day marks the return from exile of the gay and lesbian people.
There was a march on Washington for gay and lesbian rights in 1979 that drew about 100,000 protesters. This march in 1993 drew between 800,000 and 1 million, according to DC police. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.